Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 28, Episode 12. Coming up on this show, we've got the ancient god king of the North Pole, the cult of the Black Cube, and the ambiguous genitalia of the Onsen Men in Black. I'm Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
I did want to title that the smoothie onsen of Japan, but then it just doesn't have the same ring to ambiguous genitalia.
You have to be a pretty hardcore MU fan to get the term smoothie and understand that it's not a fruity drink that you're consuming in the onsen in Japan. It's something else.
Well, it's coming up in our Plus extension, so normally if you're in Plus, you probably are going to be aware as to what that is. But yes, I've got some wild Men in Black encounters coming out of Japan in our Plus extension.
Where's this from?
Japan.
Oh, where's your story from?
Brent Sponsor.
Okay, thank you.
Our source, our number one source in Nihon.
Thank you. Yes, he is an excellent source, isn't he?
What have you got coming up?
I went down a deep dive into the cult.
The cult?
Of the Black Cube.
Oh, I've been seeing this on social media recently.
It's a bit of a meme. You see these occasional posts where people give you pictures of black cubes on people's hats and black cubes outside of companies and
the
black
central banks,
the black
kind of
cube at Mecca.
Yeah,
it's some ancient mysterious cult of baby eaters.
Yes, because it's always referred to as being some type of satanic, because it links to Saturn and it's a representation of satanic forces. What's this?
Well, I'll tell you where I started today. I went to this really interesting book called The Cult of the Black Cube by this character, or controversial character, known as Arthur Moros.
Mm.
Its full title is The Cult of the Black Cube, a Saturnian grimoire. So it's like it's a magical thing.
Yeah.
And what pulled me into it was this guy's personal story, which then led further into this cult of Saturn and further into ancient history. So I ended up going into the work of David Talbot today.
Oh, yes.
The idea of this Saturn being an ancient sun god, and it was worshipped by cultures all around the world going into the distant, distant past. And that extends further into the idea that perhaps the order of the cosmos was entirely different to the ancients as to the way we see it today. Like, we look into our skies today and we presume that the ancients saw it in the same way.
You
have the sun and the moon and you have the constellations and everything's rotating at a certain speed. And we just assume that it's always been that way, or it's at least been that way for as long as humans have been on this planet. But some scholars argue that it's not the case, that the order of the heavens went through multiple cataclysmic upheavals in the memory of humankind. And this memory has come to us through myth.
Oh, so when you look at, so we're talking far greater than just recorded history. It's like a myth.
When you look through myth, you see all this symbolism of, you know, the gods fighting, like Zeus fighting the Titans and then banishing them to Tartarus, for example. We see this in the Upanishads, and it's all across the legends of Asia. And even if you go to Polynesian tribes, they have similar kind of stories. And the idea is that they're portraying something that they experienced. It's not all just some kind of metaphysical explanation for an idea. It's a description of something they witnessed. It's something they saw in the sky. And so it's funny how I went from this grimoire to this deep dive into history, but I'll explain how that happened. But I wanted to start with this guy's story because it is really intriguing, this Arthur Moros. And there's all this debate about whether he's real, about who he really is.
So it's like a pseudonym he's using?
Maybe it's a pseudonym. But in the introduction to this grimoire, he says, look, when I'm asked what particular spiritual tradition I follow, he says, I often have to resist the urge to say Saturnine Gnosis, you know, the following of the deity Saturn. He says this because the experiences, rituals, and practices that I follow are ultimately connected to thonic entities and their ruling intelligence that fundamentally is not a good or kindly being, namely the Saturnine deity. So a thonic entity is something of the underworld. It's a being of the underworld.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something of Elysium, of something up higher. It's something from down below. So we would probably call it a demon or something like that. And he says, like, explaining myself and my views and practices is often more trouble than it's worth. And frankly, for years, he says, I didn't feel any inclination to codify or share my understandings with anyone else. But he says, however, in the last several years, a series of events, coincidences, and synchronicities have run together in such a way that I believe the Saturnine deity wishes these things to be shared. So he's saying he's being commanded to write this grimoire.
So is that suggesting that he's possessed or that it's a channeling of some kind?
Well, we'll get into that. He says, I'm going to try and relate a series of occult teachings and techniques gathered from over 20 years of serious academic and esoteric research. But he says, look, first, I need to tell you a little bit about myself. And this is the story that sent me down this rabbit hole. So he says, when he was in his senior year of high school, he was in a really bad car accident, shockingly bad. He damaged his spine. His right leg was completely crippled. When he got the x-rays back, they showed that, the section of his spine that connects to his hips, his coccyx, it's completely obliterated. It's like a million pieces. It's paste. And he's in terrible, constant pain.
And he probably would be for a long time, I'm assuming.
Well, this pain stays with him during the day and it stays with him. It never goes away. It's impossible to sleep. He can't study. He can't concentrate. He can't even move without tons of medication. Mm. This is how bad it is. And he says he's sitting in agony and the damage caused to his spine, or sitting was agony, sorry, and the damage caused to his spine made him lose control of the leg that was damaged. So he could only hobble around, and he was at school at the time, like late teens, and he had to start using a cane as well. So imagine he's just like drugged out from the painkillers. He can barely walk around. He's in pain all the time. He looks like crap because he's, lost so much energy and he can barely sleep, so he can't rejuvenate himself. And he went through all the advantages of the medical system. And he said it was good, it was efficient, but nothing worked. None of the treatments worked.
You mean to alleviate the pain?
Well, to solve the issue, to alleviate the pain, to fix what had been damaged. He said his spinal specialist was concerned that if he had any more surgery than he'd already had, there was a really strong chance that the nerves would be damaged even further and he would just be a quadriplegic. Paraplegic. Yeah. So total paralysis below the waist. He spent months in physiotherapy, no change, just pain 24 hours. Chiropractic didn't work. He even tried yoga. None of it helped. And ultimately, the solution was his doctors just prescribed larger and larger doses of opiates to dull the constant pain. It was just he had to try and dull it to do anything. And obviously that's a danger in itself. Opiates are highly addictive, as we know. But he's saying back then, like he was 18 years old at the time, and this is like nearly 30 years ago now, the understanding of how bad these painkillers are in terms of addiction wasn't really widely understood.
But you know what he's also facing? He's facing a paranormal danger here, because there's two factors that we've only been talking about recently, particularly in reference to spirit possession, for example. One, heavy amounts of pain can cause psychological trauma, which weakens you, or heavy amounts of opiates also, according to some sources, claims that weakens you to, being vulnerable to spirit possession.
Well, it weakens your energy field.
Yes.
And your energy field is what protects you from spirits, as we've heard from our other research. So anyway, he's 18 years old. He's walking with a cane, but he's just going between extremes of pain from this spinal damage and extreme fogginess from the morphine that he's on. So he's just in a fugue. He's just completely in a daze all the time. And this is obviously miserable. This is a miserable state of affairs. And it lasts until he's midway through his undergraduate studies. So amazingly, he got through high school and he got accepted into university. And he's like, I don't even know how it happened. I was so drugged out most of the time. I don't even know how I got accepted. He couldn't drive. He slurred his words all the time. But the only thing that kind of kept him going was that he loved learning. He loved going to university. The stimulation of his mind was really all he lived for. He did an undergraduate in humanities and he was able to try psychology and philosophy, he said. He did also Latin and religious studies. And he said at this university he went to, the Department of Religion, it had courses on death and dying, magic and the occult, and ancient myths and semiotics. And it seemed to be they had just newly started offering these things. They had never offered these things in the past, and it was like a bit of a change in that department, and all these new courses popped up. And he was fascinated by them. And he said, on a whim, he signed up for magic and the occult. And when I say on a whim, it's not like he was particularly interested in these things. He had maybe a curiosity. But he basically needed an elective, and this one just happened to fit in his timetable. And he's like, it sounds kind of interesting. I'll do this. I need something to do. So he signs up for magic and the occult. And he said the instructor, the professor, was actually very, very good, very knowledgeable. He had really interesting discussions with this guy about the history of magic, about the ancient world, the mechanics of spells, demonology, ceremonies and ritual. And as the middle of the term got closer, this professor reminded this class that there wasn't going to be a final exam, but instead everyone would have to do a research project. Now, Arthur, he decides to do his essay on the concept of black magic in antiquity. And he says that the reason he wanted to do this is just because he loved the Conan movies with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, right.
And the whole, you know, the whole ancient sorcerer motif and the aesthetic. He just loved that stuff. He's like, this will be cool, you know. So he spends a few days in the university library and he starts digging into different texts. And he says it was strange. This is the first thing that's odd. Is this particular university had tons of texts on necromancy, black magic, curses, demons, all this material. And he thinks back on it and he's like, that's a surprisingly
odd.
Good collection of occult literature for this university. He never names the university. But he assumes, after thinking about it, that there must have been members of the faculty who were occult practitioners.
Yeah, because why would you have that much occult material?
Exactly. Or someone at the library was a occult practitioner and they had all these books in there. They placed all these books in there.
Unless through some weird serendipity, perhaps he went to, you know, a college that had it donated to them. It was like a collection donated. That could possibly happen.
It's a bit weird though. Anyway, he says one day he's going through this French monograph on Roman necromancy. And he says French. He later explains French was his first language. And he comes across this particular ceremony that's designed to placate the Thonic gods, remember the gods from the underworld, in exchange for favors. And it's a very typically Latin idea that there's a term for it, duodes, which means I give so that the deity will give, so that you, the deity, will give. It's an exchange.
Is it kind of like selling your soul to the devil?
That's probably where the term comes from. That's where the saying comes from. So the ceremony is really complex, and it seems to be based on this Thonic ritual where a ditch is dug so that black colored animals can be sacrificed and have their blood flow down into the earth. And I remember that's come up in some of our previous research with ancient cultures, remember there was this city, I can't remember where it was, but you know, it's like thousands of years ago, there's a city, and in their central section in the city, there was a giant pit where they basically did sacrifices.
Was that the one where they threw a whole heap of cats in?
Probably.
Yeah.
Probably. And then eventually people and everything else. But this is the idea. They dig this ditch and then sacrifice the animals. The whole point is that the blood flows into the earth and there's like a demon or a god that consumes it, similar to what the Aztecs were doing. And
again, blood. Note that, because that's going to come up in a story I've got coming up in Plus.
Well, when he's reading it, he feels this strange sense. He doesn't know where this thought comes from, but he has this idea that what he's reading isn't just superstition. And he starts to explain the rationale of this, because obviously the ancient people weren't stupid. You just have to look at their achievements to understand this. Look at what they built, look at what they constructed. And also, magical ceremonies in the ancient past were incredibly costly to perform. Like sacrificing a bunch of horses would be like burning your car on fire, like setting your car alight to the gods. Mm. And that they would repeatedly spend large amounts of resources and money on these practices. And why would they keep doing it if it generated no results? And he says in all of the ancient cultures, magicians were professionals too. They had clientele and they were just as respectable as a doctor or a lawyer. And with this in mind, he started to find himself contemplating the possibility of trying some of these rituals dedicated to the Thonic gods.
Oh, how foolish. How irresponsible. Well, is he wanting extra like credit?
Well, he's saying, look, it's not that I believed in magic. He said, I was in the kind of pain that you can't even describe. Like,
desperate.
Yeah, you got to put yourself in this guy's frame of mind. He's in a sense of pain that you can only describe as transformative. Like, everything around him, everything he experiences, his entire experience of the world is through this red haze of constant pain. And he adds that through the different courses he was doing and all the research he was doing, he kept on hearing these instructors, these professors, discussing magic as an actual force that could be studied, could be tested, and it had a real tangible effect on the world. But they didn't sugarcoat it either. With the research he was doing and what the professors were saying, they all pointed out that magic was a force that tended to scar the people who used it.
Oh, so there is a warning on it.
There's always a cost. And he said those who contact the spirit world tended to be sick or damaged individuals. And he said there's a body of research behind this. It's got an academic name. It's called the shamanic illness. And he says this is because most cultures that have shamans believe that the spirits contact the potential shaman usually during some kind of sickness. They're on the edge of death, or there's some kind of accident where they nearly lose their life. And we know this from the stories we've covered. There's great tribulations that are faced before a shaman kind of gains his power. That's part of the tradition, no matter where you look in the world. Mm. And since he had exhausted all the conventional medical options to resolve his pain, he's like, well, this is what I'm going through. Like, I'm on this shamanic path. I'm going through this horrible transformative illness and pain. I'm constantly on the edge of death. So he starts to do his research, and he had taken Latin, so he knew a bunch of Latin, and he essentially reconstructs the basic ritual that would put him in touch with the demones, the ghost gods of the Roman netherworld. And he thought, okay, this is probably the direction I need to go in. I can contact these Roman ghosts of the netherworld, because he said, I knew for a fact I had Roman ancestry. And in theory, he says that his ancestors must have sacrificed to these entities for centuries. So there's some kind of familiarity there. There's a blood line there. And he thought, I'll just approach these entities for help. What's the worst that could happen?
I mean, you're right. I mean, I'm shaking my head, but I guess if you are going through so much trauma and medicine has failed you and you are desperate, I guess you'd be doing anything you can.
It's like, yeah. So he said, I understand that magic involves a trade. So he said, I was prepared to offer virtually whatever they asked for. So along comes the night for the ritual. He's got everything set up.
He doesn't dig a ditch, does he?
All prepared. Well, no, I'll explain that. It's all prepared very carefully. The ritual text is all in Latin. He's relayed to John Geiger's curse tablets and binding spells for some of the passages. So he's kind of pulling it from existing sources. He's got an altar. It's got offerings of wine, water, bread, and other gifts. And he does his research, and these are things that a Roman Thonic entity would probably want. And he didn't have a funeral pit to pour blood into. So he has this big glass bowl that will receive the offerings. And he's even kitted out. He's wearing a full toga and he's got a hood on, because he knows from his research that you have to cover your head to show humility to the deities. So he begins this ritual in the dark. He's got candles lit. He's got just enough light to see the text. And the house is pretty warm. It was, like the beginning of fall. And he starts reciting this litany in Latin. And he starts pouring the offerings of the wine, then the water, then he adds the bread. And then using a knife, he cuts his left hand and he allows his own blood to trickle down his fingers and into this glass cauldron. And he says this act was perhaps the most significant thing he'd ever done in his life. Because immediately as the blood hit this receptacle, things started to change in the room. He said the temperature immediately dropped very sharply. The candles all start to dim. The flames, he said, it was strange. The flames didn't flicker. It wasn't wind. It's like they just dropped in energy. They were like someone turned down a knob. And they became so weak that it's like the darkness in the room got stronger rather than the candles losing brightness. The darkness got stronger and started to feel oppressive. And suddenly he's aware that he's not alone. He can feel the presence of multiple spirits in the room with him. And he says they did not feel friendly. Now, he'd assumed that since he was drawing on ancestral gods and freely offering his own blood, that whatever showed up would be friendly. And I'm just, why? Why would you think that?
Yeah, why would you make that assumption?
He says, stupidly, I had not imagined that whatever had come through would be malevolent or just angry at being disturbed. Then something unimaginable happens. The giant glass bowl he's got explodes and shards of glass and water and wine and bread and his blood just goes flying around the room in this big explosion. He says it didn't crack. It's not like it cracked and then fell apart. It literally detonated into tiny glass fragments. And he's like, that's when I felt real tremendous fear because I didn't know what to do. And he says suddenly it became hard to breathe as if some force is crushing his chest. And his careful preparation of, oh, domi dom, like reading the Latin, that's out the window. And now he's like, Jesus, please help me. Jesus, oh God, Jesus, please help me.
Yeah,
he's backing
out now.
Oh my God, oh my God, Jesus, please help me. He's just praying in his native French for these spirits to forgive him for disturbing their slumber.
But isn't it Steiner that said that French was like a destructive language that will bring about spiritual death?
Yes. That's just making it worse. And he's afraid to move. The entire floor is in darkness. There's shards of glass everywhere. And he's like this, like just praying out loud for 15 minutes as this presence, this is just overbearing, crushing his chest. It just feels darker and darker. And slowly, thankfully, it starts to fade. The room becomes warmer, the candles regain their brightness, and finally he feels like it's safe enough to limp across the room and turn the lights on. And of course he cuts his feet and it's, you know, it's gross and a mess. But he cleans everything up and immediately regrets trying this ritual and promises himself, okay, this is just purely academic now. I'm never dabbling in this again. That's it.
Too late. Two
nights later, he has this incredible lucid dream. Like, it's not even a dream. He's somewhere else. He says, it's so unique, I'll never forget it. He suddenly finds himself on a mountain in this really strange place. It's mostly desert. He says, the colors are all wrong, though. It's like an alien planet. The sky and the sand, they're all hues of red and orange. It just doesn't look like Earth. And there's a sense of hostility towards life that just hangs in the air. It's hard to explain, he says, but it's like a general hostility. And he didn't really pay much attention to the surroundings, though, because in front of him is this gigantic, pulsing, black energy mass. Just this throbbing kind of...
Does it have a shape to it, or is it just an amorphous
mass? It's like an amorphous... Sometimes it's a cube, sometimes it's a blob. It occasionally ripples with color. Like, you know how you see oil have those rainbow sheens on it?
Yep.
It's like that. And this black warmth, this throbbing, gross alien blob starts talking to him telepathically. It's beaming thoughts and words into his head. And he says, look, I can't go into detail. Like, I'm forbidden. But in essence, it said that his ritual had gotten this thing's attention. And that it had decided to bring him there to its realm, to its world. And this deity telepathically gives him a choice. First, it said that he could return to his normal life and he could go on as if this never happened, take the blue pill, basically. But the problem was he would still be in the same continued pain and misery.
Fascinating that you should give him a choice, though. It's like that whole idea of inviting entities in. It's like he has to do it voluntarily.
Yeah, humans have to agree to what they get. And the alternative, his other choice, is that this entity, this horrible pulsing blob, alien blob thing on another planet, can fix him. It can stitch his damaged spine back together. It can devour the trauma and completely heal him. But it will do much more than this. It's going to send him, it says, on a different path than his original fate, where he'll live an incredible life. He'll travel to interesting places. He'll learn to do strange, powerful things. And he'll have a generally powerful, fulfilling, interesting life. In return, he has to serve as a messenger of this entity in our world, carrying its essence with him, almost as if it's like a virus, like it's running through his damaged tissues. It's in his body. It's a part of him. That's the deal. His own agendas and ambitions would come second to this because nothing in life is free. He would be a servant to this entity. Now, he doesn't even blink. He doesn't even think. He's just like, yep, yep, sounds good to me. Doesn't even consider it for a second. Let's do it, he says.
Is there a part of the contract that he hasn't read? Because normally it's more than just like, what it sounds here, being a messenger, what's the long term? What happens when he passes from this plane of reality?
Well, again, the pain and the trauma has so much hold on his life and his psyche that the idea of going back to that is not something that he can conceive of. It's almost like an obvious choice that he would take this deal. And probably the entity knows that he would never say no to this deal.
You also have to wonder, though, if this is some type of, I mean, we're only recently talking about karma. Is this some type of challenge? Is this some type of test? You know, and then if he says, no, I don't want to become a messenger for you, that then he would have greater rewards. But obviously he can't get past that.
No, I don't think it's that. It's definitely not that.
It's not that.
No. It's
definitely demonic or
it's
dark.
It's setting him up to take this deal because he immediately accepts. And as soon as he accepts, he feels this energy pouring into him. He says it feels like ice water in his veins. And he feels the essence of this thing crawling into his spine. He says it felt almost like the steroid injections he would get from doctors. But he feels it working its way up in between the cracked vertebrae in his spine. And he said he just started to scream because it was the most intense pain. And this guy knows pain. It's the most intense pain he's ever experienced. And he's, And then he wakes up in his bed.
Still in pain?
Well, he says, look, I'll keep this bit short because, he doesn't want to, it's like he doesn't want to reveal too much, but he's been commanded to reveal it. He says, within a week, the pain in his spine is completely gone. Within 2 weeks, he throws out his cane. He doesn't need it to walk anymore. Within a month, he doesn't need any medication. All his medication is in the bin. He's completely off it. He's complete 100% healthy. And his doctors have no explanation for it. They're calling it a miracle case. They're saying it must have been misdiagnosed or the scans were wrong. We can't explain this. And as you can rightly imagine, it's what you would call a miracle. And he says, look, it would be exciting for me to say that, I started to receive all this razor sharp gnosis from this entity. I started to receive all this instruction. But he says, that's not how it worked. He claims this thing communicated with him through nudges, intuitions, a lot of unusual synchronicity, like books falling off the shelves that he should read or running into people for certain reasons.
So no direct communication, no telepathy, your thoughts, voices.
Well, it did eventually talk to him directly when he was ready. It allowed him to know that it was Saturn, the black cube, the Lord of Time. That's the entity he had made this pact with. It didn't ever seem to give him any work, but it did force him into graduate school and eventually into a doctorate program in mythology. He claims he went to an Ivy League school. He said he says he's been studying the various cults of Saturn in his many cultural guises and manifestations ever since. And it's interesting, he says, it hasn't been a solitary road because along the way he's been guided to meet certain people who he studied under. So he claims this entity has directed him to people who are also under its mission, I guess. And he says each of them was so deeply devoted to this deity, to Saturn. But he says some of them were public figures and you would be shocked if you found out who they were.
No, I wouldn't be, to be honest. But if his like part of his deal was to be a messenger, I mean, it's kind of worked, right? Because we've just told his story.
Now we're messengers of the dark.
I don't want to be a messenger.
The dark alien blob lord. No, we might be warning against the message.
Yes,
you never know.
That's right.
Well, we could be advocating it.
Warning. Warning.
You have to listen all the way to the end and sign up for Plus to find out if we're advocating or denying.
We'll leave it ambiguous for the moment.
If we're disavowing or advocating. So 25 years later, he says, the deity held up its part of the agreement. He's led an incredible life, traveled the world. You know, he knows people in circles of power you wouldn't believe. And he lives this life of privacy and comfort and wealth. And he says, that was all going fine until this last year. He says, the deity Saturn has now made it clear to me that it is finally time to write. And he says, look, I don't like writing about the occult. And he explains that it doesn't feel right to share your secrets and insights that you've worked so hard to accumulate and just give it out freely to strangers. You know, it's 2 decades of work. He had to suffer and travel and go through great hardship to figure these things out.
You made a deal with a demon.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like much hardship, does it?
No.
You just signed on the dotted line. But more importantly, he says, these practices, this knowledge, it's all deeply personal. He says, to me, it's sacred. And much of it is beyond conceptualization. So he says any kind of way to try and write it down, it's bound to fail, like it'll be misunderstood. And he says he didn't really want that to happen at all. And if it was up to him, he just wouldn't write a book at all. He would never do it. But as he said, he says some decisions aren't mine to make. He's driven by this entity. So what kind of entity is Saturn? And obviously, I'm not going to explore an entire magical grimoire for you because it's full of weird stuff. But not that that's ever stopped us before, but it's just not generally something I want to share with people. But we will have a look at the nature of this alien blob entity that he made a deal with. So he starts going into the medieval Islamic cosmology for answers. And the Arabic word for the Saturn deity is Zuhal, which means the one who is far away or the alien. The Saturnine deity, he says, becomes the champion of the desperate, the greedy, the rebel, and the vengeance-driven. The oldest of the primary texts considered in what he's studying is the words of Ibn Washiyar's treatise, The Nabataean Agriculture. And yeah, again, this is an old medieval Arabic text. And this author, Washiyar, writes, beware the evil of this god when he is angered, or to the west of the sun, or veiled in its rays in the middle of its return. Pray to him this prayer which we have just given here. While you are praying this prayer, give a burnt offering to his idol consisting of old hides, grease, strips of leather, and dead bats. Burn for him 14 dead bats and an equal amount of rats. Then take their ashes and prostrate yourself on them in front of his idol. Prostrate yourself to him in the form of a black stone on black sand and seek refuge from him against his evil, because, oh, my brethren and beloved ones, he is the cause of the perishing of all that perishes, the cause of decay of all that decays, the cause of perdition of all that is destroyed, the cause of sorrow of all the sorrowful ones and the weeping of all the weeping ones. He is the Lord of evil and sin and filth and dirt and poverty. Oh, what a great deity to make a deal with.
Sign here. It'll be fine.
Yeah. It's just get rid of your pain. Sounds like a good deal. So finally he says, if you pray to him or pray to him so that you might escape his evil. And obviously there's more occult references that are similar to this. He mentions this occult book called The Picatrix, where Satan's power is cold, stinky. He's associated with misfortune, betrayal, viciousness, terror. He separates and scares. He's involved with depression, grudge, cunning.
Negativity in
general. Old age, fatigue, sadness, death. You get the idea. And later on, very much later on, he says, because he discusses all these cultures, like he goes into the Hindu mythology of Saturn, he talks about the Greek mythology of Saturn. And in all of these cultures, he says Saturn's physical presence, his idol, is a black stone, a black cube, or an obelisk. And the current idol of Sarni at one of his most prominent temples continues to be the black stone even now. The Kaaba itself, which is the stone at Mecca, was originally an icon of the time deity of Saturn. It's another prominent example of the black cube. He says it is significant that the black stone at the heart of the Kaaba is said to be black iron fallen from the stars, which according to Islamic law makes it Saturn or Saturnesque by definition. The cube represents the maiming and constraining of Saturn and the prison dimension, Tartarus, to which the deity is confined. And that is, it's interesting because that's a continued theme throughout all cultures, that this great god was killed by another god, sometimes his son, sometimes a relative, sometimes just another god, but cast away, sent away into the darkest depths, because Tartarus is like the very lowest level of the Greek underworld.
Right.
It's like the hell of hells. And it's considered, in some occult circles, it's considered like a prison dimension where the most powerful enemies are sent, because that you can get no access to it. And once you're sent there, you can never escape.
Does it have similarities to God casting out Lucifer? Is it the same kind of thing?
You know, I haven't actually looked at that. I'm not sure if it's from the same mythology. But yeah, it's obviously connected in some way, perhaps. Mm. And again, he says the black cube appears in contemporary art, in media projects. It's often a symbol of alien menace. He talks about Clive Barker's Hellraiser cubes, the Leviathan deity itself. Even a Google search for black cube, he says, shows an extensive list of corporations that use the black cube as a symbol. And you'll see this if you do a search, Google image search for black cube. You just see all these corporate plazas where they got a giant black cube. And this, of course, has led to all these conspiracies that the black cube phenomenon is like a subtle tip of the hat to this cult of Saturn that has remained kind of secret and in the shadows for a very, very long time. So I wanted to dig into this further. I wanted to dig into the whole black cube thing, the Saturn myth, the cult of Saturn. I wanted to see where this goes. And I ended up grabbing an old copy of David Talbot's book from 1980, The Saturn Myth. And again, he starts talking about this idea that most of us, when we think about the heavens, we think that it's been the same again for our ancestors. They look up in the sky and they basically see what we see today.
Yeah.
In primitive times, you had the sun, the moon, the planets, they all appeared just as they do today. But he says the evidence indicates that within human memory, extraordinary changes in the planetary system have occurred. In the earliest age recalled by man, the planet Saturn was the most spectacular light in the heavens, and its impact on the ancient world was overwhelming. In fact, he says, Saturn was the one great god invoked by all mankind. The first religious symbols were symbols of Saturn, and they were so pervasive that the planet god's influence made the ancients see him as the creator, the king of the world, and Adam as the first man. Now, he mentions that, you know, there's hardly an ancient tale that doesn't speak of some kind of world-destroying upheaval, a shifting of cosmic orders. Like, world mythology is full of this, as we know. And Talbot points out that, like, only a handful of scholars in the past 300 years have tried to make a connection between these myths that talk about these cataclysms and actual real catastrophe, like something that really happened. Like he mentions William Whiston from 1696, who first argued that the deluge resulted from a cometary cataclysm.
Yep.
No one cared.
No.
No, no one cared. In 1882 and 1883, Ignatius Donnelly wrote two books, Atlantis and the Antediluvian World and Ragnarok, The Age of Fire and Gravel. He claimed that a massive continent called Atlantis once had, you know, the story, an ancient amazing civilization, but sank beneath the sea. And it was real. It's based on a real history. Sold a bunch of copies, But obviously no one cared, like didn't change any views on history. And then he had Isaac Vail around the turn of the century, argued in a bunch of academic papers that myths of cosmic upheaval are related to the collapse of ice bands that used to surround the planet. No one cared. 1913, he had Hans Horbiger, who wrote Glacial Cosmogony. And basically he argued that Earth captured another planet in ancient history that became our moon.
Oh, yes. Yep.
Nobody cared. And then you have Velikovsky, comes along in 1940. And he first wondered whether there was a cosmic disturbance that accompanied the Hebrews leaving Egypt, the Great Exodus.
Yeah, he thought it was a comet, didn't he?
Well, you know, he talked about massive plagues and Sinai erupting and a pillar of cloud, fire moving through the sky. And he started to investigate this. And basically, many of you will know Velikovsky, but he did this survey of world mythology, and he came to the conclusion that ancient myths were a collective memory of some celestial disorder.
Mm.
The great gods, he observed, appear explicitly as planets. And in the Titanic Wars from Greek mythology, the planets moved on erratic courses, their orbits changed. It's almost like they had battles with each other in the sky. There was electrical discharges between them that would menace the Earth as well. And he wrote Worlds in Collision in 1950, proposing that Venus and then Mars from 1500 to 686 BC actually disturbed the Earth's axis and caused massive destruction. And a huge seller, like, obviously, Velikovsky, hugely popular, very controversial. He actually got people to debate the idea, which is a huge achievement. People started to take note. But obviously, as we know, it didn't change conventional understanding. So Talbot says the reason he's mentioning these authors, and especially Velikovsky, is because it was Velikovsky who directed him to Saturn. And there's this manuscript, and I think it was around 1980 when Talbot wrote this. And at the time, this wasn't published. So I don't know if this eventually came out. But there was this manuscript that Velikovsky was working on that Saturn was once the dominant heavenly body. And he identified Saturn's epoch with the Golden Age, with the legendary Golden Age that almost all cultures speak of.
So by heavenly body, does he mean more so than the moon or...
Closer than the moon.
Really?
It's very close. Like Saturn is the biggest thing in the sky, basically.
That's so we could actually see it in the rings?
Well, I don't know if it had rings back then. Okay. That goes into a long story. So it's the preeminent light in the heavens, but that idea inspired Talbot to start looking into this, and he expected to find maybe faint echoes of Saturn or maybe nothing at all in the ancient writings. You know, looking back to the beginnings, he thought, you know, maybe there'll be a mention here and there. But when he actually started to look into it, he said the ancients were obsessed with Saturn, absolutely obsessed with it. It was by far the most worshipped, the most written about, the most central deity in almost every ancient culture. And they were obsessed later on in ways, thinking of ways to relive Saturn's epoch, to bring back the one great god, Saturn, that was always Saturn. And the most common symbols of antiquity are solar emblems, right? And we think of them today as, oh, okay, the ancients worshipped the sun. They had all these emblems of this disc, this sun, and a lot of the translations are that it's like Helios is the sun. But he says a lot of this came later. And when you actually go to the original age of the myths, they don't refer to the sun, they refer to Saturn. They explicitly refer to the planet Saturn.
So why has it changed? Why did history mess this up somehow?
Well, because later people will look in the sky and go, well, obviously they're not talking about Saturn because it's just this tiny prick of light up there in the sky. So they must have been talking about the sun. So Helios must mean the sun.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't possibly be talking about that tiny pinprick of light. So the whole point he's saying is that it wasn't a pinprick of light, though. It was like the biggest thing in the sky. And he says, if we are to believe the widespread accounts of Saturn's age, the planet god's home was the unmoving celestial pole, the pivot of the heavens, far removed from the visible path of Saturn today. So again, it's got almost nothing to do, and it's completely unrelated to where Saturn is today. So he starts going into this mythology, and one of the first kind of universal themes you see with Saturn is this idea of the Great Father. Like anyone attempting to trace the Saturn legend with the primordial god figure, he says, all these different races call them the Great Father. He's said to have first organized the heavens, founded this kingdom of peace and plenty, the Golden Age. And he says these early astral religions insisted that this planet god was the all-powerful ruler of heaven. But again, today,
you would assume it's the sun.
Well, you would just, who can pick out Saturn in the sky? I don't know where it is.
No, I mean, you can see a bright planet, but normally, isn't that Venus or?
Yeah, it's like a bright star up there somewhere, but how would it serve to create a mythology that encompasses the entire world?
Unless there was some type of, I don't know, belief system at the time that had caught on and it had spread out, maybe? Is that possible? No, there would have to be something there that everyone could see, surely, back then.
Yeah, that's getting to the key of his argument. But the paradox here is that the ancient people also declare that this god-king Saturn was the biggest thing in the heavens, but also resided on Earth as a great king. He was the father both of gods and men. There's this dual character, and Talbot says it's been a debate for centuries. Like, it's very confusing. Like, was he a living ancestor, or was he like this cosmic divinity? Like, which one is it? Sometimes he's given human proportions, but also he's this giant thing in the sky, in the heavens that people can see. So he starts to describe what the ancient myths say. It's all to do with a great god. So the myths say that the god emerged alone from the cosmic sea as a preeminent power in the heavens. Out of watery chaos, he produced a new order. The ancients worshipped him as the creator and the supreme lord of the cosmos. Number two, this solitary god, according to the legend, founded a kingdom of unparalleled splendor. He was the divine ancestor of all earthly rulers, his kingdom, the prototype of the just and prosperous realm. Throughout his reign, an unending spring prevailed. The land produced freely, and men knew neither labor nor war. So, Golden Age. Number three, in the God King's towering form, the ancients perceived the Heaven Man, a primordial giant whose body was the newly organized cosmos. The legends often present the figure as the first man or the primordial man whose history personified the struggle of good and evil. And four, widespread traditions proclaim him to be the planet Saturn. He's Saturn. So the best material, he says, is the oldest. To understand this, you got to go to the older stuff. So he says you got to go to Egypt. You got to go to Mesopotamia.
What age are we talking here? 3,000 roughly years ago? Older. Okay.
Older. What's like 7,000, 6,000, okay. 7,000, 8,000 years? But now we know it's older with Göbekli Tepe.
Well, that was 12,000, wasn't it?
That's 12,000. So you got to go back, really far back. And the way we think of monotheism today, there's like an evolutionary understanding, like there is with everything. There's the idea that human beings, when they're backwards, they're uncivilized, they have multiple gods. They have spirits for everything, right? They have this kind of pantheistic idea. And as civilization develops, this slowly evolves into monotheism. So you have one god. But Talbot says there's no evidence for this. Like, this also rests on the assumption that civilized races of old had to pass through primitive phases. But he says, actually, there's not really evidence for this. Because before the Hebrews, Greeks, or Hindus developed their monotheistic ideas of this supreme god, they must have possessed beliefs that were similar to like African tribes or Australian Aborigines. But the problem is there's no evidence of this. The older you go back, they always talk about this one god. Like Egypt and Mesopotamia, they have this tradition of a great god revealing, like it goes back into prehistoric times. So if you actually look at the historical record, monotheism was first. That was the first thing that people believed in, is this one great thing.
Well, that's interesting, because you'd expect if there were different cultures that they would come up with their own gods. So that's where you, I can see this evolution where you would go from, you know, polytheistic ideas to the monotheistic. So that kind of makes sense, unless there was something that was universally seen by different cultures.
Unless there's one thing that no one could ignore, it's like right up in everyone's faces. So let's look to Egypt. He talks about Atum, and the ancient Egyptian texts have this figure. Atum was a god born in the abyss before the sky existed, before the earth existed. He, in the pyramid text, the really ancient pyramid text, he says, "I came into being of myself in the midst of the primeval waters." In the Book of the Dead, it states that Atum was alone before he had repeated himself. He was alone in the primeval waters. The followers of Amen proclaimed their God, the Ancient of Heaven, Father of the Gods, the Splendid God who existed alone in the beginning. So it's like this one singular thing. And there's different names for this primeval deity throughout Egyptian gods, like as you progress through history.
But it's still the same entity.
Yeah, the whole idea is always the same. It's the God one, the only one, the Father of the beginnings, the Supreme Lord, the singular God.
Does this become Ra?
Yeah, this is eventually Ra came out of this, right? And the important thing to note is that everyone can see him. He's literally there all the time. And Talbot says, look, if you go into the ancient past and you look for an unseen creator, some kind of metaphysical, etherical influence, you'll be disappointed, because this god is a visible, concrete power. He's a lord of terror, the great terror, they call him. The memory, he says, of this solitary light god and creator was as old as the most ancient Egyptian ritual.
So perhaps I'm getting ahead of you here, but you'll obviously explain it. The fact that he was this god of terror, does that imply from, you know, a more kind of, all right, was it that Saturn was much closer to Earth and it was causing some type of environmental disruptions because of gravitational field effects? Like, is that what was being interpreted as an angry terror god?
Well, when they say terror, they just mean powerful.
Right.
Like, they don't mean that it's necessarily...
It wasn't causing cataclysms.
Evil or... actually, it's the opposite. He's causing the Golden Age.
Right.
It's great, powerful, which terror is like powerful. But again, this is the theme, is that this great god brought the Golden Age, brought the age where there's no suffering and men live for 1,000 years and all that sort of stuff. But the thing is, this obviously eventually ended, and the departure of this great god, Saturn, brought about great destruction, brought about chaos. And so also, if you move to Mesopotamia, there's this great researcher, Stephen Langdon. He did this prolonged study of Semitic and Sumerian sources, and he concluded that the veneration of spirits and demons had nothing to do with the origins of the Mesopotamian religion. He wrote that both in Sumerian and Semitic religions, monotheism preceded polytheism. It preceded any belief in good and evil spirits. There was always just this one giant thing that everyone believed in. And he says, if you look at the pictographic tablets of the prehistoric period, there's a picture of a star that repeatedly appears. And this sign, this religious symbol, it's a star symbol, but it's also the ideogram for God, high, heaven, and bright. And it's also the symbol for Saturn. And it's a giant circle with like an eye in the middle of it, a big dot in the middle, this universal symbol. And then you've got An or Anu, who came later, the father of the gods. Again, terrifying splendor, the central light in the universe. He governed from his throne in heaven in the cosmic sea. And then you go into Babylonian pantheon. You've got Enki and Ninurta and all these evolutions of the same god. But each shares the same character, all this ruling universal lord that emerged from a celestial ocean, giving radiating light in the heavens and brought on a golden age. And again, this god created the earth and the heavens, right?
So if an ancient group of people could have seen this thing being close in the heavens, like Saturn being close, what took place to push it out of that orbit, that position?
Well, this is really important, because what he's saying is this is something that people experienced and saw. This is something our ancestors witnessed. And when the ancient myths say that the God created the heavens, this one God created the world. It's this weird paradox because the ancient texts write it as if they were there watching it with their popcorn and binoculars.
Mm.
Like the pyramid texts say hearts were pervaded with fear, hearts were pervaded with terror when he was born in the abyss. The solitary God in the presence of the ancestors brought forth the primeval world or earth. And this tradition, it really, you've got to understand it in the way that they're obviously not talking about our earth. Because if there's people around to witness it, like, that doesn't make sense. Like it's not, the old texts can't be talking about our world and us. They're talking about something that they saw, something they saw in the sky, something they saw in the heavens. He says the subject of the original creation legend is the formation of the great God's visible dwelling above, something they saw. The legend records that when the creator rose from the cosmic sea, a great band or revolving island congealed around the God as his home. The band appeared as a well-defined, organized, geometrically unified dwelling, a celestial land fashioned by the Great Father, and all space outside this enclosure belonged to unorganized chaos. And he says, like, the words in ancient languages that are denoted to heaven, cosmos, world, land, earth, Netherland, in their original sense, these words meant the same thing, a band of light which appeared to set apart the sacred ground of the great God from the rest of space.
What could that be?
So the great God, it sounds like a heavenly body, and they explicitly say that it's Saturn in these texts, but there's some kind of celestial phenomenon that the ancients are describing. They're describing like a belt or a band, and they're describing that the God is coming out of the ether, like it's coming out of this ocean, so you get the sense of some kind of energy in the sky.
Well, it's a gas giant, isn't it? So if something hit it or struck it, perhaps with enough force, it could cause it to seem like an ocean. It could force something out.
Yeah. And then he gets into this idea of the universal monarch. So this cosmic figure, all the older races call it the creator God, the supreme God. Again, he reigns over the golden age and he governs over the entire world, becoming the model of a good king. Every terrestrial ruler receives his charisma and authority. He's the divine predecessor. So this is really interesting because ancient people trace their ancestry to this God. But again, it's like this paradox. Like if it's a God in the sky, in the heavens, how is it also a monarch that rules on the earth? So Osiris, for example, the ruler who led the Egyptians out of barbarianism and reigned as the king of the entire world, who was that? Who was Enki, who the ancient Sumerians revered as the universal lord and the founder of religion? And he starts going through all the different cultures. And we know many of these names, like we know Quetzalcoatl from the Mexicans. We know the Hindus have Yama. The Greeks have Kronos. The Chinese have Huangdi. And he goes through all these other examples from North American tribes as well. And this universal monarch idea forms the first chapter of Chronicles of Kingship, no matter what culture you look at. And this theme emerges that in the original age of cosmic harmony, the gods dwelt on earth, and presiding over the epoch of peace was the universal monarch. He founded temples and cities, taught humanity the principles of agriculture, law, writing, music, and other civilized arts. This golden age ended, though, with the god-king's catastrophic death. And again, this ruling on earth while being a god in heaven, how did the ancients come up with this paradox? Like, what does it actually mean? This is really confusing. So he starts going through the age of Kronos, and this is like the Greek legends, this mysterious era of Kronos where he's the creator god. But in the old tradition of Kronos, that there's deathless gods who dwell on Olympus, made of a golden race of mortal men. They live like gods without sorrow of heart. They're free from toil and grief, and the earth is fruitful, and the land has many good things, and everything's blessed. And you see the same story with the Egyptians. They talk about this paradisal age, this peaceful epoch under Kronos, but it's like a different title. Eventually it becomes Ra or Osiris. But in each tale, no matter where you look in the world, whether it's China, because eventually Huang Di lost his kingdom and the empire fell into destruction, you look at the Greek mythology,
the story's the same.
Yeah. Eventually the god is murdered and this brings worldwide destruction. Doesn't matter where you go. Like you go to Chaldea, he's got examples there. He's got the Babylonian examples of Enki and his wife. They have this pure paradise, then it's destruction after they've gotten rid of. And it's all over the world. Quetzalcoatl, India has Brahma, Iran has Yima. And in each description of this heavenly king, this heaven man, like even if you go into Adam, he starts talking about Adam. Like according to Hebrew legends, Adam's stature was so great that he extended from earth to the center of heaven. His countenance obscured the sun. Adam was Lord on earth to rule and control it. The myths say that the people took him to be their creator and they all came to offer him adoration. But in the Gnostic and mystic texts, Adam is not a mortal. He's a cosmic being whose body contains the seed of all later creation. He's a man of light occupying the center of the cosmos, radiating energy along the axis of the universe. He's the creator and supporter of the world. His body encloses all elements of life. It's actually not talking about a man. It's like a heavenly prototype of man. And the modern day Mandaeans of Iraq know Adam as the king of the universe, the personification of a spiritual man. And he goes through all these examples like Hindu Yama and Manu and all these examples of the symbolic man. And his body essentially forms a circle of lesser gods. So again, there's this idea of a circle forming with all these other gods. And sometimes the gods are called his arms or his legs. But again, no matter which culture you look at, you're getting this symbol, you're getting a picture of a giant god in the sky. With a circle around it. And this god was killed and this celestial order collapsed. And again, you could see it. Like everything, if you dig into its roots, he claims it's about seeing something. So even if you look, you know how like the word of God is the creation, like God speaks and the world is created. This idea is in a lot of cultures, but the root meaning of the Greek and Hebrew of word actually means visible speech. And there's similar ideas in Chinese history as well. There's this philosophical idea in ancient history that, and this is from John Allegro, another researcher, who says the creative word of God originally wasn't an abstract motion. You could actually see it. You could see the word of God. So in the Hebrew creation legend, the speech of the creator is poured out as spittle or seed. You can see it. It's the spurting out is associated with thunder and shrieking wind. It's like a phenomenon that can be observed. And in most creation legends, he points out in Egyptian and Sumeria as well, this great father, this god in the sky, has these life-bearing rays, and his word, his voice, all appear as powers that are seen and heard. So again, it's not a metaphysical thing. It's not just an idea.
No, it's very much physical. And further to what I said a little bit earlier there with the suggestion of it being, you know, terror, but you're right, maybe it's not terror, maybe it's power. But if it's a celestial body that large and that close, surely it would be having a significant impact upon Earth, which would be witnessed by people.
And again, if you go back, and he goes back through all these cultures and each great god they're all talking about, it always goes back to Saturn. It always goes back to the god Saturn in various different ways. Like he talks about the Latin poet Ovid, who spoke about the first millennium was the age of gold, so the golden age. Then living creatures trusted one another. People did well without the thought of ill. But then Ovid writes, old Saturn fell to death's dark country. It's always Saturn that, and if this was about a religion that worshipped the sun, what it doesn't make sense. It doesn't, like, this is this weird paradox. And again, like, people have obviously, other researchers have noted this through history, but they've always just gone, huh, isn't that interesting that an ancient cult revolved around Saturn when it's just this weird light in the sky, like this tiny little prick of light.
But to enhance his argument, wouldn't there be some, I mean, I noticed that you said there before that, you know, there was a lot of obsession in the ancient world with Saturn. But is there any type of astronomical evidence that some type of event took place? Is it recorded somewhere that there was a massive explosion in the sky by a different culture? Or, like, what's happened for this thing to leave?
Everything I'm saying to you is the recording.
It's the recording, right.
Every myth is the description of what happened.
But they personified it as a god.
Yeah. Yeah, this is just, well, it was their god. Like, if it's the biggest thing in the sky, the most incredible thing that you can see every day you wake up. And again, he goes through, like, the Hindu king of the world was Satyavrata, Saturn. Mm. The Canaanites, the Hebrews, they had corresponding with the Sumeria Babylonian An, their god was Saturn. Yima, the Iranian transcript of the Hindu Yama, god of the Golden Age, was Saturn. The Zoroastrians knew Saturn as the heaven-sustaining Zervan, the king and lord of the Long Dominion. The Chinese Huangdi, mythical founder of the Taoist religion, is acknowledged to be Saturn. Even the Tahitians talk of Fetutea, which is Saturn, and that he was the one king. Again, why? It's so bizarre. So let me give you the myth in a nutshell. In the earliest age recalled by the ancients, the planet or protoplanet came forth from the cosmic sea to establish dominion over the primeval cosmos. This planet god ruled as the solitary central light, worshipped as the god one, the only god in the beginning. Saturn's epoch left a memory of such impact that later generations esteemed the god as the universal monarch, the ideal king. And throughout Saturn's era of cosmic harmony, no seasonal vicissitudes threatened men. They had no seasons. The temperature was universal, the entire world. Everything grew all the time. There was no hunger, no starvation. There was no labor, no war. It was like a perfect paradise. Now, that, let's just stop for a moment and think about that. What would cause a universal temperature around the entire Earth if not a different sun?
Yeah, good point. A different sun or some type of possible influence of another heavenly body.
In the creation, Saturn, the primal seed, ejected the fiery material, which congealed into a circle of lesser lights, the cosmos this is referred to. The myths describe this resounding birth of the secondary gods as Saturn's speech, as the word, the voice of heaven. The ancients conceived Saturn as the visible intelligence bringing forth the cosmos as his own body and regulating its revolutions. Thus was the planet denominated as the heaven man, as Adam, as the primordial perfect man, and eventually thought of as our ancestor. When Saturn departed the world, and it's different depending on which mythology, whether it's Zeus killing his dad or Zeus attacking the Titans, once the Saturn is deposed, the Golden Age catastrophically ends. So if the Earth is under the influence of a different heavenly body and it's creating this perfect environment of even temperature, the quality of the light is different, things grow in a different way, and suddenly that's gone and we're now under the influence of a different heavenly body, it would create chaos. Everything that grew naturally under the light of that other heavenly body now
no longer will. Their environmental conditions have changed.
It's like completely changes. So this is remembered as catastrophes by the people that witnessed it. This is the first universal tale of a dying god, the overthrown first king, the fallen first man. And the result is the same, a corruption of nature, progressive worsening of the human condition. And Talbot says this story, one could say, is perhaps the only theme of tragedy and drama in antiquity. It's like this universal theme. And each culture refers to it as, it's Saturn. Saturn's golden age came to a sudden and catastrophic end, either caused by or accompanied by the fall of the great god.
Following this, is there any connection to flood myth?
Yeah, the flood myths is a big part of it, which I'll get to in a moment. But again, yeah, how can this be reconciled? How can this be explained? So again, Saturn is this speck of light in the sky. Could a tiny speck of light really be responsible for driving all the, these myths of world mythology? Could it really be behind it, this tiny little prick in the sky, this tiny little prick of light?
Well, it doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense. It would only make sense if our ancient skies were different, if the cosmic order was very, very different. And that's what we're going to talk about after the break in our Plus extension. Because obviously, if any of this is true, if any of the mythology of the ancients is to make sense, if they really are describing things that they're seeing, we have to be able to understand how it took place.
Yes.
How, well, if the ancient world was different to the cosmos we see today, how did we get here to where we are today? How did we go from the one god, which everyone says is Saturn? How did it end all the way up out there?
Well, and also, what type of event could have possibly have taken place, which is powerful enough to move a planetary body as far away as it is, but not affect the Earth severely and wipe us out? What kind of explosive, powerful event could take place that has that ability?
And notice in like the myths, again, to go back to Zeus taking on Kronos and sending him down to Tartarus. Tartarus is the is a prison. It's a prison dimension.
Yes.
It's the furthest away you can get from our world. And it's the opposite of Elysium, which is, you know, the heavens. And it's the idea of Kronos, Saturn, being cast out, sent far, far away.
Oh, wow. Yes, it is.
Locked away in a prison. And when we look up in the skies today, where is Saturn compared to the Earth? It's way far
out. Yeah.
It's, look at the orbits, way far out. Like it's been cast away, like it's been imprisoned in the furthest reaches of our solar system, like Tartarus. So we're going to investigate that when we come back for our Plus extension after the break. And we're also going to discover what actually happened to the cult of the Black Cube and Arthur Moros.
Okay.
What happened to this guy?
Yeah.
'Cause he wrote this interesting book. He wrote this grimoire. He told us his story of making this deal with a giant throbbing
black cube,
black ball of goo on an alien planet. He made a deal with it. What happened to the guy? Did he write a follow-up? Did he get his message out? Is he still out there today? What does his Twitter account look like?
Just lots of pictures of black cubes.
That's all it is. Black cubes. He's selling black cubes.
Maybe he's the one that's promoting all those conspiracy theories that people see online about black cubes.
We'll get to all of that in our Plus extension coming up.
Don't forget,
of course,
Japanese smoothies.
Ambiguous genitalia of the onsen men in black, as only Aaron can tell.
And blood ritual chupacabras.
Nice, nice little add-on there. That's coming up in Plus. If you want to sign up, head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. All the details are there. $9 a month, get access to the big extensions we do every single Friday. And of course, you get access to the exclusive shows we do on Tuesday as well. You're getting more than double the content if you sign up for Plus. Plus members also get a totally ad-free version of the show. And if you sign up for MU Max, you get access to our entire back catalogue of the billions of shows. That's what it feels like. Billions of shows that we've done over the last
decade.
It's longer.
12 years, 14 years.
16 like, years. Over the last like, yeah. 16 years. 16 years.
There's a lot of episodes in there.
Sign up today, mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. Help support your favorite show. That's a wrap for this free edition of MU. If you're on Plus, stick around to find out what the hell happened to our cosmos after the break. For everyone else, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. Plus extension.